Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, March 25th. Maybe you've already heard, coming out of the Senate this morning, they call it the biggest economic stimulus bill in U.S. history. Maybe we should really call it an emergency grant to many Americans so we can afford to stay home and stop the virus bill. It includes 4 months of full pay unemployment insurance of that type for many people, from what I've read, tries to cover many freelancers and gig workers in that, as well as staff people, $500 billion in loans to businesses, which they cannot use for stock buybacks, by the way, and more. At least this is the way it's being reported before it actually gets voted on. That's one big coronavirus and money story, but the other one remains the life and death question that New York and President Trump have been fighting each other on for the last week. Can the private sector on its own produce the ventilators, the masks, and other supplies that are so desperately needed here more than anywhere else, as we have a majority of the cases in the nation in greater New York? Or does the president need to invoke the Defense Production Act to direct companies to make more and make them now? We'll talk about both these things and more now with Catherine Rampell, syndicated opinion columnist at The Washington Post, political economics commentator at CNN, and special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Catherine, we always appreciate your time and insights. Thanks for coming on.
Of course, anytime.
Let's start with the spending bill. I know this is still emerging. Can you tell yet if this is really 4 months of full pay for a lot of laid off workers?
So if you look at the letter that Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York and minority leader for the Democrats, had sent to his colleagues, what it actually says is that it is going to basically top up existing unemployment benefits by $600 a week for 4 months, and that laid off workers on average will receive their full pay during that time. So it's a little bit unclear, since we haven't seen the legislative language, or at least I haven't seen the legislative language yet, exactly how that will function. But basically, it will increase the amount of unemployment benefits, but it doesn't mean that every single laid off worker will receive their full salary.
So on average, that could mean like the median salary in America, which maybe is $50,000 a year or something like that. So up to some number like that?
Potentially. And look, every state allocates unemployment benefits a little bit differently. It's really more like 50 plus different unemployment benefit systems, if you're including DC and other places. Mm-hmm. So exactly how that will work will vary somewhat by state. Here in New York, there's this complicated formula for determining what your base pay was when they're deciding, you know, how much you were earning before versus what percent of it should be replaced. And there's some version of that in every state. But basically what will happen is the federal government will enhance existing benefits. And they've already allocated through, I think it was the phase one bill, maybe it was the phase two bill. It's hard to keep track. Mm-hmm. They had already allocated more funding for states to administer those benefits, because that's also kind of a bottleneck here, right? That you're hearing stories of people having difficulty applying for the benefits. But the feds are essentially giving more money to the states to actually process the applications and to top up what they would be giving otherwise, and extend how long they will be available for.
Can you tell if and how freelancers and gig workers will be covered without the payroll checks that staffers have to prove their incomes?
So Schumer and the Democrats have said that this will apply to gig workers. The language in the letter, I have it in front of me, is it ensures that all workers are protected, whether they work for businesses, small, medium, or large, along with self-employed and workers in the gig economy. But again, how the math will work out is a little bit hard to tell just from that language, because traditionally, that's not what the unemployment insurance system is designed for. So I guess we'll have to see exactly what the provisions in the bill look like to know what the base period is. You know, there isn't an hourly wage that many gig workers actually earn. Mm-hmm. Some of them do, some of them don't. So figuring out what the base of income is to determine what will be replaced of that, I think is a little bit yet to be seen. But it is a hopeful note that lawmakers are taking into account freelancers, gig workers, since they are a very large part of the economy now.
So before the Senate agreed on the spending bill, you wrote in the Washington Post that the Republicans wanted as few strings attached for business as possible, while Democrats wanted a tangle of yarn for accountability. How did it wind up?
What it looks like, again, based on the vague outline that we have so far, is that there is more accountability for how that money, in particular for large businesses, airlines, and others, will be allocated and dispersed. So there was sort of a middle ground that appears to have been reached. And I had also seen that there is language that they agreed to, essentially saying that the president, lawmakers, what looks like cabinet officials, and other and members of their families cannot benefit from the so-called bailout funds that are being distributed, these loans and loan guarantees that are part of this legislation, which is an accountability measure. And there's some other accountability measures in there as well, including a congressional oversight panel, some of which is cribbed from TARP, as you may recall, from the last major economic crisis that
the
we had.
The bailout in the financial crisis, yeah, 10 years ago.
Right. And so, and that was one of the concerns here, that basically there's this trade-off between flexibility and accountability. You want the money to go out as quickly as possible. You also want to make sure it's spent wisely, and that it's going to people and businesses who need it. It's not lining the pockets of the people who get to decide where the money goes. So there's a little bit of a trade-off here, and there were concerns about the last version of the bill that essentially there were very few constraints on how the money got distributed. It didn't have to be disclosed for 6 months who benefited from it. There was no congressional oversight panel. There was no special inspector general. Again, some pretty basic things that were part of the last bailout package, which still had, of course, major problems, including just, you know, initially you saw firms. Again, this is the financial crisis bailout, TARP. You initially saw some firms continuing to give dividends and things like that.
Which is why at that time, from people on the left like Bernie Sanders to people on the libertarian right like Rand Paul and his father Ron Paul, there was opposition to that bill.
Right. So I think what was the compromise that was struck this time around, it appears, takes some of those tools from TARP and adds some additional strings attached as well, including, again, saying that, for example, the president or cabinet members can't personally benefit from this money. But it still appears that the money can be spent as quickly as is possible. And that's really the challenge, no matter what. Even if you have basically no strings attached to this money and Secretary Mnuchin can just cut checks to everyone willy-nilly, it's even if that were the case, it's still going to take some time for the money to get out the door just because the plumbing of the system is slow. And the other thing that we haven't actually talked about so far is that in addition to assistance through the unemployment insurance system, there is also assistance going out to households in the form of direct checks. So which the idea being that that would get out more quickly.
And I see that's going to be means tested. It might be $1,000 plus per individual, but only up to, I think, if you make $75,000 a year, and then it phases out.
Correct. So it phases out, I think, for up to those earning more than $99,000 a year, something along those lines. That's for, I believe, a single person.
I read that too.
And families would also receive an additional $500 per child. So to clarify, when I was saying before that, you know, laid off workers on average would receive their full pay for 4 months, and that would leave out some people, we do have to recognize that there's this sort of one-two punch approach that people are going to be eligible for unemployment benefits. They're also going to get a check. Again, unclear how quickly that will get out, but hopefully more quickly than approving a lot of this other money.
Now, before we go on to our other topics for this segment, maybe this is just semantics for economics wonks, but they call this a stimulus bill, the same term they used when there's a recession, like in 2008, 2009, and people aren't buying things. But this is really something different. I said before, maybe call it an emergency grant to many Americans so we can afford to stay home for a while and stop the virus bill when the economy was otherwise humming along. Congress isn't really trying to stimulate activity for the word stimulus. Is that distinction right? And does it matter to how they do it?
Yes. So traditionally, when you have a recession, the goal of fiscal policy is to boost what's called, what economists call aggregate demand. It's to get people to go out, engage in more economic activity, to shop, to buy stuff, to invest, etc. But for obvious reasons, that is sort of the opposite of what we want people doing now, right? If you don't have to engage in some sort of economic activity that requires face-to-face interaction, we don't want you to do it. So the goal right now is not to get people to go out and spend money. It's to help people survive if they cannot go to work for public health reasons, whether because they themselves are sick or because we don't want to expose more people to this illness. And because there's a slightly different challenge here that requires slightly different solutions, right? It's about kind of encouraging people to be able to engage in this, what I've called a collective economic coma, even though their financial obligations do not go into that coma simultaneously, right? Just because my job is on hiatus doesn't mean that my rent is on hiatus. So what we really need to do is to help people survive so that they can continue to pay their rent, their mortgage, purchase groceries, medications, whatever it is they need day to day. And that's part of the reason why this is being designed as it is. We're trying, or lawmakers have said, okay, we're just going to cut people checks to try to replace their income. I don't know if this is actually in the legislation, but there was discussion, at least in the last few days, about changing the requirements for how you maintain eligibility for unemployment insurance. For example, in many states, there are requirements that if you want to continue receiving unemployment benefits, you have to continue applying for jobs, right? Or which might mean knocking on doors and things like that.
Right,
which we don't want people doing. And the other thing, the other reason why that might not be an appropriate condition for continuing to receive benefits is that the reason why people are laid off is not necessarily because their business doesn't need them forever. It's just that they don't need them for a couple of months. So we don't really need them necessarily to be applying for new jobs. We just need them to be able to hang on while they're waiting for their existing job to reemerge from this economic coma. So I don't know if the language has changed, but there had been discussion about changing those kinds of requirements.
And many of the recipients will be, now full-time parents staying at home, which is a full-time job as well. Let me move on to the life and death question of how fast ventilators and masks and other equipment can be produced by the private sector without the president ordering companies to make more through the Defense Production Act. Here is New York's Governor Cuomo sounding as urgent as I've ever heard him yesterday after Washington sent 400 ventilators from a national stockpile.
What am I going to do with 400 ventilators when I need 30,000? You pick the 26,000 people who are going to die because you only sent 400 ventilators.
And here's President Trump resisting the plea to have the federal government do the allocation. He said governors need to buy their own ventilators, including very much Andrew Cuomo.
He had a chance to buy in 2015 16,000 ventilators at a very low price, and he turned it down. I'm not blaming him or anything else, but he shouldn't be talking about us. He's supposed to be buying his own ventilators.
Catherine, there are really several policy questions rolled up in that one exchange. One for you as a business reporter is, will companies on their own manufacture ventilators and masks and other things as fast as possible? Or would it really go much faster to face the shortage if the president orders some companies to do it under the Defense Production Act? Is the answer to that question even knowable?
We do know that even if companies start working now, and many of them have said that they're doing this on their own without, you know, without Trump activating, well, we've gotten mixed message about what they're invoking from the Defense Production Act, to be clear, but without the administration, you know, using force of law to order companies to do this, they have actually said that some of them have said that they're doing this already. And yet, the actual production or the successful production of ventilators, for example, is still probably months away. And that's really the challenge here, that if the administration had reacted to the shortage in February, a private sector effort starting now might have made this kind of equipment in mid to late April. But now it's unlikely to be completed before June. And part of the challenge is that all of these kinds of products, whether we're talking about ventilators or other critical equipment, relies on complicated supply chains. So there are companies that are trying to scale up. I think I had seen that Medtronic, which is one of the leading manufacturers of ventilators, now makes about 225 of these machines per week, up from 100 in more normal times. Mm-hmm. But it can't scale up that quickly because it relies on, you know, more than 1,000 parts from 14 different countries, and they're trying to scale up even more, but it's just difficult. So without having activated this act a couple of months ago and sort of gotten every part of the supply chain focused on this is the priority, ignore every other order that you have, or at least put them on the back burner and focus on the parts needed to go into this supply chain, without that having happened, it's going to be a couple of months away. I think Ford, for example, had also indicated that it was partnering with GE Healthcare and 3M, and they're aiming to produce about 1,000 respirators per month using fans from F-150s. But and parts from 3D printers, but those parts still have to be merged with things produced by other suppliers. So there are companies that are trying, but without some sort of centralized order saying everybody put this first, the real challenge is getting this stuff on the market quickly enough.
By the way, just to fact check a claim in the Trump quote. It's not really why I played it. I was just trying to give an example of him saying he's not going to invoke the Defense Procurement Act or Production Act for ventilators. But he accused Cuomo of having the opportunity to buy a lot of ventilators for a good price in 2015 and passing up that opportunity as a reason the federal government doesn't have an obligation now, as if that lets the federal government off the hook if they're the ones that can save the most lives. But from what I'm reading, that's a pretty thinly sourced claim. Do you have any information on it?
I do not know if Cuomo had been given a, you know, a really good deal a couple of years ago. I'm skeptical that even if he had, you know, if somebody had gone into an alley somewhere and opened up his cloak and said, hey, you want some ventilators? You know, I got a good price for you. They fell off the back of a truck or whatever scenario we're envisioning here. I'm skeptical that states would have been, you know, would have had the wherewithal to know that there would be a pandemic a couple of years from now and that this would be worth investing in. You know, by definition, this is a novel coronavirus. We didn't know that we were going to face a global pandemic. No states knew that. So even if they had a good deal, I can understand why they may not have, said it within their tight budgets that this was mm-hmm. worth spending money on. Generally that kind of responsibility is reserved for the federal government, which is supposed to be thinking about long-term national security concerns and contingency plans for all sorts of black swan events like this one.
Here's another example of how the federal government could at least hypothetically use the Defense Production Act. It comes from the writer Max Brooks, son of the comedian Mel Brooks. It's, I think, a hypothetical example, but he writes about the government telling a condom manufacturer to stop using their latex for their usual product for now and get their latex to companies making protective gloves that the healthcare workers need. And again, I don't know if that's a real need or just a clear way for Max Brooks to say how that might work, but do you know if corporate lobbyists are out there for condom manufacturers or anyone else leaning on the president not to do things like that?
I don't know about condom manufacturers specifically. I know that there has been reporting suggesting that a number of firms, because they're facing their own stresses right now, are pushing against those who are asking for the Defense Production Act to be activated because, you know, they're trying to make ends meet and they don't want to lose control over whatever it is they think their own priorities are in order to not go out of business.
Let's get to one more coronavirus and money issue. President Trump says he wants to open, or at least partially open, the economy again sooner rather than later, because with this massive shutdown, he says the cure might be worse than the disease. That implies, though the president didn't say it, that it could be better for more people to die, mostly older people, from coronavirus, because more people will be exposed, than to suffer the consequences of a prolonged shutdown. Where that logically leads is to an almost unimaginable question to even have to ask. Is society willing to sacrifice those lives to stave off intense economic deprivation? And here is the almost unimaginable answer to that question, or one person's almost unimaginable answer to that question, from Texas Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick Monday night on Fox.
No one reached out to me and said, as a senior citizen, are you willing to take a chance on your survival in exchange for keeping the America that all America loves for your children and grandchildren? And if that's the exchange, I'm all in. And that doesn't make me noble or brave or anything like that. I just think there are lots of grandparents out there in this country like me.
And obviously that is just jaw-dropping, to say the least, for people who never heard that before. I'm sure you've heard that clip, Catherine, because it's been circulating for a couple of days in the media now. He said that in the context specifically of supporting the president's reopen fast approach. Do you know if the president himself has endorsed or denounced it or any other reactions?
I don't know that he has responded to that particular claim, that particular statement. And there have been others, either in right-wing media or elsewhere, who have made similar arguments like, oh, yeah, I should be willing to die for the sake of the economy. And those kinds of statements have been caricatured as well as, you know.
Responded to, criticized,
responded,
denounced.
Denounced, yes. I think there are two things that I would say about that, besides the fact that I think these are awful and immoral priorities, that we should just sacrifice our grandparents essentially for the sake of the economy. That is not the priority that that we should be having. We should be putting human lives first over the Dow or over, you know, GDP growth. The other is that even if that is your priority, boost the economy at all costs, the lives of elderly and those with existing conditions be damned. It's not clear that that's even the right strategy for achieving your goal. Because if we quote unquote reopen the economy before we have this pandemic contained, that doesn't mean that we're going to have economic growth just suddenly bounce back, because people are still going to be afraid to go outside. There are going to be businesses that have a lot of workers out because they're sick. And in some sense, you know, an economist with Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, put it this way, that if you declare victory before the virus is under control, that could mean a deeper and longer recession, because more people get sick. After a few weeks, you might need even more severe containment measures. And so I think there's a false choice here between doing what's good for the economy and doing what's good for public health. Doing what's good for public health in the long run will probably improve economic outcomes.
Catherine Rampell, syndicated opinion columnist at The Washington Post, political and economics commentator at CNN, and special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, It's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.